Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
And now, cars, people, cities. Can we all get along?
The shape of our cities will change as expanded highway transportation decentralizes our population centers into vast urban areas. With the advent of wider, faster expressways, the commuter's radius will be extended many miles. America will someday be crisscrossed by a network of super-speed transcontinental motorways.
It's the 1958 Disney vision of Magic Highway USA, where pedestrians and machines would all live in peace. The reality is more like a menacing image from the Russian avant-garde, a Malevich of cramped spaces and predatory machines. Even though the number of pedestrian deaths in the city of New York today is far below the 952 recorded in 1929, 152 pedestrians and cyclists were still killed in traffic-related crashes last year. What if it could be zero? Why do we tolerate any pedestrian traffic deaths at all? Vision Zero, an initiative started in Sweden, being applied here in New York, aims to eliminate pedestrian deaths by 2024. Peter Norton is a professor of history at the University of Virginia, who says even though Vision Zero sounds ambitious, he says if we built our cities, we can decide to control how cars and people interact.
When people are killed in traffic in public places on public roads, why don't we consider that a public loss the way we consider the deaths of soldiers overseas as a public loss to be grieved publicly, recognized publicly, and dealt with as a public problem? We used to do that, and we stopped, and we began to privatize these losses. And when we did, they became a lot less important as public issues.
And they became no longer news stories, and you didn't read about it in the paper. And
you can see it. Yeah, you can see it on the newspaper coverage. It starts out as front page news, lots of articles, editorials, editorial cartoons, letters to the editor about these problems, and you can see them disappear over time.
What, as a professor of history, gave you the idea that something like this could be changed? Because it seems as though it's so deeply seated that people are going to tolerate, oh, well, that's just what happens. And now all of a sudden we are in a situation where, no, there's just a hugely heightened awareness.
We've changed before. We changed about 90 years ago from a society that was very intolerant of these sorts of fatalities and injuries and one that grew to accept them. And that transition wasn't a natural evolution. It was a real effort. And I think we can learn from that effort to change again.
Ultimately, what we've seen in the awareness of there are bike lanes, there are commercial vehicles, there are private vehicles, and there are pedestrians. But we've never really established the priorities of who gets to use the roads. Why is that?
By default, the priority has gone to the fastest, most threatening and intimidating and powerful street user, and that's the driver of the motor vehicle. They didn't always have the assumption behind them that the streets are for them. That was a real revolution and a very contested and messy one, although it's usually presented to us as if it was a sort of natural evolution in response to what people preferred, but it wasn't that simple at all.
In the traffic world, one of the things that we tolerate that I think nobody could ever imagine going away is the fact that in New York and in most big cities around the country, there are two lanes taken up by parked cars. I mean, if somebody from 100 years ago or 150 years ago were to come and take a look at New York, they would think that it's been taken over by some disease. There's some scourge. The wide lanes, the wide open pedestrian causeways, the walkability is all gone because we tolerate parking. Do you think we'll ever get to the case where people's private vehicles will be stored somewhere else other than the city?
Well, we're seeing more and more calls for exactly that. I think you're sort of thought model there, imagining somebody from 100 or 150 years ago looking at our city streets today and how they would respond is a really useful thing to do, because naturally, inevitably, when you grow up with a phenomenon, the phenomenon will seem normal because it's familiar. And this makes it harder for us to look at it and ask us if it really makes sense. When the automobile began to arrive on city streets 100 years ago or so, you see reactions that are very interesting because they reflect a perspective that's completely changed. In other words, 100 or 110 years ago, the automobile was thought of as kind of an intruder who would be tolerated on condition of good behavior, but an intruder who was still quite burdensome in some ways in terms of the space it took up and also in terms of the new risks that it introduced. The newspaper coverage of the time, the letters to the editor at that time, even the expert traffic reports of the time, tend to characterize the automobile as this nuisance intruder that needs to be restricted so that we can continue to use streets well and not squander their space taking care of these enormous vehicles everywhere.
What do driverless cars offer as a potential for radically reorienting the extent to which private and public vehicles share the streets?
Driverless cars could mean all kinds of different things depending on how we use them. I'm surprised sometimes to see reports where driverless cars are presented as if they're a sort of automatic, inevitable solution to problems like traffic congestion and safety. Driverless cars could exacerbate urban sprawl enormously by doubling commuting distances as people figure, you know, my time spent in the car isn't wasted anymore. I can go online, I can do my work, I can play while the car is driving me. So why not drive twice as far to work? And if that happens, we're looking at a city that not only has more sprawl, but also becomes, as a side effect of that sprawl, less walkable, less amenable to bicycling, less amenable to public transportation. There are other driverless car futures that are much better, like, for example, people who have limited access to mobility, they can't drive a car for various reasons, or they just prefer not to own a car, can get a car. So I see driverless cars as a tool that could really help other systems, but I don't think that they are a solution in and of themselves at all.
Peter Norton is an associate professor of history at the University of Virginia and author of Fighting Traffic, The Dawn of the Motor Age in the American City.